Welcome to Tough Talk Christian Radio. Tough Talk Christian Radio is for those who want to share and receive expressions of faith that will help take you to the next step in your relationship with Christ. Tough Talk Christian Radio is brought to you by the Tough Talk Radio Network. Now here's your host, Tony Gambone.
Did you know that an estimated 52 million Americans listened to internet radio in the last month, or that weekly internet radio audience has increased 60% over the last year, and that more than 8 in 10 people are online from any location? Tough Talk Radio Network is a company dedicated to providing a platform that allows opportunities for guests, hosts, and sponsors to market themselves to the internet radio media where they can be heard by millions. To find out how Tough Talk Radio Network can help you, go to toughtalkradionetwork.com.
Tune in every Thursday morning at 9 a.m. to Tough Talk Christian Radio with Tony Gambone. Tough Talk Christian Radio is for those who want to share and receive expressions of faith that will help you take the next step in your relationship with Christ. Listen in to hear from others about their experiences of faith and the love of Christ. Call in to share your experiences at 347-989-1363. Learn more by going to toughtalkchristianradio.com.
Okay, I think we've got the problem situated. John, can you hear us now?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay, very good. Sorry about that. Anyway, John, let's tell the people a little bit about who you are and where you're calling in from. So I know I mentioned that you're in the Netherlands, and I think there's about a 7 or 8 hour difference from the U.S. But John, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes, I started to write books about personal development in 2008, and the reason why I started to write books was basically out of frustration. I've been reading voraciously for decades about psychology, history, religion, philosophy, and at a certain point I could not find books that were sufficiently practical and sufficiently realistic, and I thought I could start writing books myself, and I have been doing this already for many years. Book number 8 came out last year in November, and there will be another book this year in October.
Now, John, have you always been a writer?
No, previously I developed a commercial career, still working on it, and I have been writing books now since 2008, and I plan to expand my writing the next decades. So my goal is to write still many, many books and continuously gathering material for my next books. And I hope to bring out at least one per year.
And what brought this upon you, John? What made you one day just say, hey, I want to be a writer. I want to write all these books. And is there something in your life take place that this is a helpful way through it? Or is this something that you just decided you had a passion for?
Well, basically, I write the books. I would say I write the books for myself because I want to find in the books I write very practical prescriptions based on data, based on history, based on facts. And I have been a passionate reader of history and psychology for many years, and I put them together in my books about personal development. I try to develop prescriptions and ideas that have universal application, and they are based on real cases. So what I do is to extract from history of culture, religion, from many centuries, to extract ideas that we can put in practice in the 21st century.
So let's talk about some of the books you've written. I mean, we started, I think one of the first books you did was When Everything Fails, Try This. And you are saying that you've written the books to basically help yourself. And I have found myself that, you know, we write books to help others, but at the end of the day, we really do help ourselves more than anything else. So what made you decide to do it? Was there something in your life that you wanted to change your career direction, or this has just been a passion of yours all your life?
It has been a passion for many years. And I think when you read a lot and you think about what you read, eventually you get down to writing. I think it's a natural process. Of course, you need some time and you need some dedication to that, because it takes a lot of work to put together a book, to edit it, to make it attractive for readers. It's a lot of work, but I think it's a natural progression from reading to writing. Sometimes it takes decades, but if you think you have something to say, I think inevitably you will end up writing books or writing articles or having a show on the radio. Eventually, you will find an outlet for what you have to say.
That's very true. That's very true. And so, John, tell me what you do for a living. What is your 9-to-5 job?
Well, I'm developing a commercial career already for decades, and what is particular about it, it's international. As you can tell by my accent, English is not my mother tongue. I have been working in different countries. I've been to the U.S. Quite often in the last decades. But this combination of international, commercial, and languages and culture, I mean, it has been driving my life since an early age. And I really like to see different cultures, different ideas. And in the end, what I try to condense in my books is the wisdom that, to a certain extent, the wisdom that I have been able to accumulate in a lifetime.
So I'm looking on Amazon, and if people go to Amazon and type in your name, I'm going to spell your last name. It's John, VESPASIAN. You'll find all the books there. And I'm looking through here, and what I'm looking at is, just seems like an everyday struggle could be the title of the book. When everything fails, try this. On becoming unbreakable, how normal people become extraordinary self-confident. Consistency, the key to permanent stress relief. Stress relief. But what I'm seeing here, John, is it's like everyday struggles are put into books. Now, are these kind of a self-help way of getting yourself through those hard times?
In an abstract way, you could say that, but the books are not based on my life. All the stories and all the arguments in the books, they are based on historical cases. I analyze biographies and history for centuries, and then I try to draw conclusions. So yes, you could argue that they also apply to me, but I try to keep a distance between what I write, and I try to quote always reliable sources to make the books objective and to try to have ideas that are universal. I don't think I can use my life as an example, neither positive nor negative. I think it's much better to look at stories from history. And I always try to have rational, practical conclusions that people can put into practice right away.
Okay. Well, you know, John, this is we're a Christian radio show. We I give the credit to everything that takes place to the Lord. I want to know how... what's your thoughts on that? Are you a reader of the Bible? Are you a follower of God? Is this anything in the Bible come out in any of these books? Can you talk about that?
Yes, a lot, because our Western civilization, to a great extent, is based on Christianity. And many of the stories that come in my books as examples of positive or negative behavior, they are linked to the Christian religion. And let me just give you an example. One of the ideas that comes in my books recurrently is that you have to interpret your religion or your philosophy with a lot of common sense. I mean, it's very good to have confidence in the Lord and to read the Bible, but it should not be disconnected from your context, from your long-term goals, and you have to put it in a way that it makes sense. I mean, one of the stories I tell in my books is the story of Leon Tolstoy, who was a Russian writer. He became very famous early in life because he wrote a couple of bestsellers. He wrote War and Peace. He wrote Anna Karenina. And by his early 40s, he was really a huge success in Russia. But at that point, he became a Christian, a radical Christian, and very much he understood religion in a very radical way, very much, I would say, irrational. He took it to an extreme that was completely out of context, and basically he destroyed his life. And I really analyzed the example in detail because I think this is something that people should be warned against. I think there is many positive forces in religion, but if you take Christianity in the way that Tolstoy did, and you become completely out of touch with reality, I mean, Tolstoy basically, he gave away all his possessions, making his family very, very worried because he had a wife and had children, and they were completely horrified that they were basically put on the street. And Tolstoy basically, he gave away his copyrights, and then he wandered away from his house trying to preach in different villages. And the result of that is that it was in the winter, he got pneumonia, and he got an infection, and then he died. I mean, the whole thing was a complete disgrace. And this is the example of how you should not understand religion. I mean, religion has to be applied practically in your life. You have to use it with common sense. You have to go there for inspiration, but you should not turn it into a destructive force.
That's an interesting take on it. That's interesting. And I know that everyone has a different take on Christianity and letting God lead their life or giving up their possessions. It's quoted in the Bible a lot of times that, you know, about your possessions, you can't take them with you. So I guess I like the fact that you say common sense. You do have to have some common sense in there. But for me, I give it all to the Lord. I let him direct me. And I find that it's better than me trying to direct myself. But anyway, I just wanted to get your take on that. Which one of your books do you feel as though was your favorite out of the 8 books so far? And I know that every book we write gets better and better, but there's got to be one that was a personal favorite.
Yes, my personal favorite is called The 10 Principles of Rational Living. This is an introduction to, I would say, to my thinking, to my philosophy. I have tried to put in this book, I think, the main ideas of how you can lead a well-balanced life, a life which is smooth as much as possible and which is, I would say, happy without going to extremes. Because one of the ideas that I really preach in my books and also by example is that you should always try to avoid a stupid risk and a stupid behavior that from time to time it might work out well, but most of the time you are playing against the odds. And this applies to your personal relationships, applies to your career, applies to your health. If you just do foolish things, eventually you will get a negative payoff. And I think we should not use any kind of beliefs, whether religion or philosophy, to try to justify irrational, foolish behavior. And this is something that you see, unfortunately, very often today and very often in history. And what I have done in this book, The 10 Principles of Rational Living, is to try to draw from history patterns of behavior that systematically lead to good results.
Okay. And that book is called The 10 Principles of Rational Living. And I'm looking, and as I mentioned before, people can go on to Amazon and find all this information. You're well listed there. And John, I know that I'm not pronouncing your last name properly. Could you pronounce it properly for me?
It's Vespasian, John Vespasian.
Okay. And I'm going to spell it so they can find it on Amazon. It's Vespasian. first name John, and there's right now 8 books. There's another book coming, I believe you said. You're writing another
one? Book number 9 will come out in October, November this year, 2017. And it's always a struggle to write a new book because research takes months. And what really requires a lot of effort, and people, I think, if they are not writers, they usually underestimate how much effort it takes to edit a book, to go through it once, twice, three times, sometimes 4 or 5 times, until it becomes easy to read and it's pleasant. It has a pleasant format and presentation. And this takes, for me, takes months. I'm trying to improve with every book to be a bit more efficient and more proficient in what I do. But there are few people, I think, in history who have been able to write from the first time perfectly. It always takes a lot of work to get the right sentences, the right punctuation, and the right flow of language. And this is always a struggle.
Yes, that's probably the hardest part of the book is editing it. And then, of course, marketing it is another chore as well. So, you know, writing the book is the easy part, I think. Editing it and marketing it and getting the message out there is the hardest part. So what do you find after you go through all this work? How do you market your books? I know that you're doing internet radio shows. Is that the only form of marketing you're using, or is there others?
Well, I have been writing for years, and I have to tell that I only started to do marketing in a systematic way in 2016. Actually, I started in January. And after trying different approaches, I have to say that I have settled determinedly and I think definitively on interviews, because I really love to do interviews. I do it in different countries, on the radio, I do podcasts, also newspapers and magazines. I try to do as many many interviews as possible, because I have found that it is the best way to get the message across. If you use advertising and you use, Google ads or Facebook or, I don't know, any kind of small ads or big ads, the message is too short. Since I usually write books which are quite philosophical and about history and religion, unless you have some space to develop the ideas and to actually have some exchanges with the media outlet or with a journalist or with a radio show moderator, it's very difficult to get the ideas across. So I am definitely set for interviews. I'm doing interviews many, many times a year, and I will continue to do that in the future.
Yeah, it's probably the easiest way to get the message out there is through the internet radio process and podcast. Do you find that people purchase your book when you do the interview?
The process, as far as I can tell from experience, is that when people listen to something on the radio and they say, okay, this looks interesting, or who's this guy? I never heard of this. The first reaction and the normal reaction is to be skeptical and say, okay, just another writer, and what is this? I don't really believe anything. But sometimes they are curious enough to take a look on internet. They go to Google, they look me up, and then they go to the blog. They start to look at different articles and stories. And if they're really curious, sometimes they will read articles from my blog. And eventually, if they really like the writing, they will buy some book. So it's a process which is not immediate, but it's a well-proven formula that from the audience of any radio show, any podcast, there will always be a small percentage that would be curious about the ideas, and they will take the trouble to actually look it up on Google or Yahoo or whatever, and then they go from there. So yes, it's a system that works, but I'm realistic that there are not many people who actually read books. It's only about 5% of the population, and I'm really talking to that 5%.
I like the fact that you understand it's a process. A lot of people that are authors that come on the show, are wanting to sell, you know, 20, 30 books an interview immediately. And people have to process and they have to learn more about it. And so what I like to do is make sure that people understand that it is a process and you've gotten that down and you're using that tool as for marketing your book. And I think that's very smart because with today's process, I think the easiest way through it is by using the internet, having these shows, and they don't go away. You're able to use them as a marketing tool as well. John, what's the future looking like for you? Are you looking at doing your own radio show, or are you just going to be doing interviews and writing books? What are you looking like? What is the end game looking like for you?
Well, the story, as I see it to develop in the next decades, I would just summarize in one word, and the word for me is acceleration. At a certain point, I will be able to do many more interviews because I will become much more effective in my marketing. I will become better known. So the number of interviews and the size of the media will accelerate, and also the writing will accelerate. Now, at the present moment, I'm able to write one book per year. My ambition is then to go to 2 books per year, 3 books per year, 4 books per year. I'm able to write fairly quickly. It's just you have to find the time. So as I transition to, I would say, to a more successful traction in my writing, my key word for the future is acceleration. So I hope that in the next decades, I'm able to write many more books, to do many more interviews. But I would not see this as doing something fundamentally different. It's just to do it faster, to do it better, and to do it in a wider spectrum in number of countries and a number of outlets.
Hmm. Now, I got a question for you. Do you find that in the different countries that your interviews are different? Are they basically the same? I'm curious about that.
Well, I have done interviews so far in Spanish. I've done in Argentina. I've done in also in German. I've done in Austria and Germany. And little by little, when you enter a new market, it takes some time to get interest from the media. But my goal in the next years is to consolidate those markets and to expand into markets which for the moment I have not been able to enter. So the content of the interviews is not fundamentally different, but I have to adapt the arguments and the context to the different media. And you don't get the same kind of questions from a guy in Argentina that you get from a guy in Austria, because they have a different cultural context. So I have to really adapt the message. But yes, fundamentally, the process is the same.
Okay, so we're running out of time, but your newest book, Thriving in Difficult Times, which everyone should read because it seems as though our world gets more difficult as the days go on. But I want to ask you a question here. I mean, this is about the ancient Greeks, and one of the questions here I have is, so how do you learn from Greek? It says that this is based off of Greek heroes. How do you learn from the ancient Greek heroes how to stay optimistic in the face of obstacles?
Well, the answer is very simple. They just did it for centuries. I mean, you take a look at ancient Greece, they were able to thrive for 1,000 years while other cultures around them were collapsing. And how did they do it? They do it by having a long-term perspective. It's, I think, the only culture you see in the ancient world where people were extremely patient. They were able to build commercial relationships for years. They put up beautiful buildings. Sometimes they took decades to do that. And they have an extreme patience to develop their businesses and their lives and their relationships. Their theater, we still watch movies that are based on ancient Greek stories. And this long-term perspective and this peace of mind that you see inherent in ancient culture, I think is the key to their success and the key to their resilience, because many times they experience huge setbacks when they were invaded by the Persians or they were attacked by the Romans. They really have to face huge problems, but they have this serenity in their character and their culture that allow them to be extremely resilient. And this is the main message from this book. If you manage to acquire this attitude in your life, you will guarantee that you will not go down when things are really getting hot. And this is something that we can certainly learn from the ancient Greeks.
Well, there you have it, folks. There's a lot of good information in all of the 8 books here and that John has written. And, I mean, a couple of things that I want to point out. One of the things that you said in this interview is about common sense. And sometimes it just comes down to common sense and just paying attention and, you know, trying to follow along what someone else is doing to create success in their life. For me, as I mentioned earlier, I find that my strength comes from the Lord. Other people find different ways of doing it. I have found that this works the best for me. Now, reading your books and looking at your books on Amazon, there's a lot of ways for people to be able to, it seems to me by the titles of the book, how to participate in a confusing world a little bit easier based off of the history that has happened in the past from others. So there's a good learning tool there for a lot of people out there as well. So one last question, John, we're out of time here, but what I'd like to do is find out this year, 2017, what is one of the things that you hope that people will realize that they're doing that could help their life in the future? You know, what is one of the things that you could advise people that they might want to take a look at other than reading your books? Just a little tip of how they might be helped if they try to do something different this year.
Yes, if you can learn only one thing this year and to change your habits, I would say try to cut off the noise, because we live in a world where you open the newspaper and it seems that the whole civilization is going to collapse. And this is absolute nonsense. And unless you get a bit away from this noise, you're going to go crazy yourself. So one thing you learn from ancient Greece is that you see the life will continue and the economy today is quite sound. Many companies are doing extremely well. So don't get so much worried by these daily events, because they will pass. Like many things else, life will continue and you will continue to do well as long as you focus on the important things, and you have to cut off the noise, otherwise you will become extremely anxious, and this is a complete waste of time.
John, let everyone know how they can contact you, purchase your book, or just have conversation, or have you on their radio show.
Yeah, it is super easy to find me. You just type John Vespasian on Google, and you will find my blog, my books, many interviews on the radio. So very easy to find. Just type John Vespasian on Google, and you will find it in a second.
All right. Well, John, we appreciate your time today, and we would really appreciate the fact that you're calling in from the Netherlands. Once again, the internet radio process makes people from around the world be able to touch on things together. So we're very thankful that we have this internet opportunity, and I hope that you'll come back and visit with us when your next book comes out, John.
Many thanks, Tony. It was a pleasure to talk to you. And have a great Sunday.
Thank you. You too. Folks, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back with my next guest, a gentleman by the name of Robert Bowie Johnson, Jr., who is a lifelong writer, graduate of West Point, and an infantry veteran from the Vietnam War. He resides in Annapolis and with his wife, Nancy. So I'm real interested in getting Robert up on the show. So we're going to take a short break. And I want you to make sure to go out and check John's Amazon site out where you can find all of his books. And you can Google him. And I'm going to spell his last name because I can do that easier than pronounce it. It's V-E-S-P-A-S-I-A-N. John V-E-S-P-A-S-I-A-N. Lion. Check them out. A lot of great books. And I believe that if you're, you know, up on the fence on some things, maybe you're struggling with some stress, this could be helpful to you. I'm going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Did you know that an estimated 52 million Americans listened to internet radio in the last month, or that weekly internet radio audience has increased 60% over the last year, and that more than 8 in 10 people are online from any location? Tough Talk Radio Network is a company dedicated to providing a platform that allows opportunities for guests, hosts, and sponsors to market themselves through the internet radio media, where they can be heard by millions. To find out how Tough Talk Radio Network can help you, go to toughtalkradionetwork.com.
All right, welcome back to Tough Talk Christian Radio. My name is Tony Gambone. I'm here every Sunday from 7:30 to 8:30 Central Standard Time. We just finished up our first interview with a gentleman out of the Netherlands who has written 8 books and is working on number 9. His goal is to start writing 2 books a year. Anyway, I love the consistency that he has, but what's more important is the discipline. To write a book and to go through the process is a lot of work. So, John, we look forward to having you back on the next show with the next book that you come out with. My next guest now is Robert Bowie Johnson, as I mentioned before the break. He's a lifelong writer, a graduate of West Point, and a veteran of the Vietnam War. He now resides in Annapolis, Maryland, with his wife, Nancy, and I want to waste no more time and welcome Robert to the show.
Thank you, Tony. Everything sound all right on your end from me?
Sounding great, Robert. And first of all, I want to say thank you for serving. I'm at the age where, you know, I was, I think I was a junior in high school, maybe a senior in high school when the opportunity was over for Vietnam. And I'm kind of thankful for that. I have a lot of relatives who went through the war in Nam and not very proud of the Americans and how they acted when they came home from Nam. But that's another show in itself, Robert. I'd like to talk to you about how you got started as a writer.
Well, I actually came back from Vietnam. I had some very unpleasant, shall we say, experiences there, and I had to write about them, and I just started to write about them. I wrote letters to the editor. I did whatever I could to explain what was really going on over there, and that we had basically a no-win policy, and it was just going to go on and on and on. And then there was a magazine called The Progressive back in those days. I don't know if it's still around or not, but I met the Washington editor, and I wrote up. I was very upset about the My Lai massacre, and it seemed like the result of our policies, really going down there and killing all those innocent people. And they didn't make the generals responsible for what had happened, or even the colonels. They blamed it all on Lieutenant Calley, if you remember. And so I wanted to write an article about that, and I couldn't really write that well. The editor of this publication just sat down with me. We were up to like 4 o'clock in the morning at his townhouse in Washington, and I learned more about writing right there. And then I just kept on writing and writing, and then I, I'm a graduate of West Point, as I say, our guardian goddess is Athena, and her helmet's on the Academy crest, and I just always wondered, what's she all about? Why do we have this goddess as our guardian, and who is she? And she's supposedly the goddess of war and wisdom. And so I just started to look into it little by little, and I saw her Parthenon idol image. If you start to search for Athena, you'll find an image of her Parthenon idol. They've rebuilt a imitation Parthenon in Nashville, and they've put inside of it an imitation 40-foot tall image of Athena. And if you look at it, she's got her shield, and she's got a huge serpent rising up next to her as a friend. And then in her right hand, she has Nike or victory. And I thought, this is a simple message. This is the woman whose friendship with the serpent led to humanity's victory. And I'm thinking, you know, this, what is this? I mean, this is her wisdom is the serpent's wisdom. So I started to look more and more into it. And in these days, you can go and look at the mythology books, but you'll find out a little bit, but not much. But in these days, we have available to us all these magnificent images on the internet of Greek art. And that's what really started to help me understand what was going on. For example, Atlas. Most everybody's heard about Atlas, and they think that he supposedly held up the earth. But when you go back and look at the art, the vases that were painted 2,500 years ago, he is not holding up the earth. He's pushing away the heavens, and with them the God of the heavens. That's what he's doing. And it turns out when you look and try to figure out who these Greek figures are, these Greek gods are, we see that Lamech, who is the last king or the last leader of the line of Cain in Genesis, he's mentioned in Genesis 4:22, we find out that Atlas is actually Lamech. That's who he is. And he is also depicted as holding the apples from the serpent's tree. And he's pictured as figuratively giving these apples to his great-grandson Nimrod Heracles after the flood, so that he becomes the one who embodies the serpent's wisdom after the flood. Maybe I'm getting too complicated here, but my book is Genesis Characters. Well, my book is Genesis Characters and Events in Ancient Greek Art. My latest book is full color, and you can see the images for yourself. I have 2,500-year-old images of Nimrod and Noah. Noah was depicted quite often in ancient Greek art. And Nimrod is depicted, Nimrod never hurts him in these vase images. Nimrod just pushes Noah out of the way, blocks him, pulls him back, ransacks his house, but never hurts him because historically he never did. And, it's amazing. And some of them are so beautiful. I've got one at GenesisInGreekArt.com. GenesisInGreekArt.com. I put an image up there of, I think I've got that image of Noah, of Nimrod and Noah. And the vase was a tall vase. A lot of people think these were really small vases. Some of them were very big, maybe 3 feet tall, or with these magnificent drawing paintings on them. And some of the paintings rival Renaissance art. And some of the better ones are what they call red figure vases, because they were made out of the red clay from that area, then painted black. And then the artists would chip away the paint to let the red figures come through. And some of them, they're just so magnificent. And there's one, I'm looking for it, Genesis in ancient Greek art. Let's see, Nimrod usurps the authority of Noah, and you scroll down, and there's this magnificent vase, red figure depiction, these two beings, these two men, one young and strong, and it's obviously it's Nimrod. The Greeks called him Heracles. And he's coming after Noah, and he grabs, Noah has a scepter as a symbol of rule, and Nimrod, Heracles, grabs him by that wrist that's holding the scepter to say, like, look, I'm taking over the rule now. And, you're getting out of the way. And there's another one where he just simply pushes Noah out of the way. So imagine 2,500-year-old images of Noah, and they're still teaching our children in school that they evolved from worms and reptiles by chance. And because, you know what, the Greek religious art boasts of the triumph of the way of Cain after the flood. That's what it's all about, overcoming the God-fearing sons of Noah. And so they boast about that in their temple art and in their vase art. And they go back to they depict the ancient garden with the serpent entwined apple tree. I've got one of those depictions right on the cover, where a woman is tending to the serpent around the serpent entwined apple tree. And of course, in Genesis, it doesn't say what kind of tree it is that the fruit was on that Adam and Eve ate. It's from the Greek tradition we get the idea that Eve ate an apple. And then, of course, you've got the Greek equivalents of Adam and Eve, who are Zeus and Hera. Zeus and Hera are a married couple. They're the first couple, according to the Greeks. Zeus is known as the father of all, Hera as the mother of all. And all the Greek gods are descended, not all the Greek gods are descended from them, but all the relevant Greek gods in the Way of Cain are descended from them. And Hera is known as the goddess of marriage because she's Eve, the first woman to be married, and she's also the goddess of childbirth because she is Eve, the first woman to bear children. And once you see it, it's obvious. I was just giving a short presentation to someone the other day about this, and they really didn't know much about it at all. Very few people do. And his thing was, gee, I wonder why people haven't seen this before. I don't know. It's been hidden. But I think part of the reason is we haven't really had these. Well, we have academia, which they're basically atheists. And they can't see a connection between the so-called gods in ancient Greek art and the book of Genesis. They can't, because it validates Genesis and it destroys their atheism. So things can be as plain as day, like this ancient garden with the serpent entwined apple tree that the Greeks depicted so often, where Zeus and Hera originated. So it's really Genesis characters and events in ancient Greek art is a fascinating read. It's full color throughout, with all these images of and I was telling you about Atlas earlier. He's wrongly thought of as holding up the earth, when actually he's pushing away the heavens, and with them the god of the heavens. I was just searching on the internet, and one day out of the blue, and there's not many ancient vase depictions of Atlas, and there was one from, I think it was the Dallas Museum, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing, because it showed Nimrod and his father Cush coming towards Atlas. And for the first time I'd ever seen, I don't know if it's anywhere else or not, Atlas was seated on a throne, showing that he was a king. And, of course, I identify him directly with Lamech. Now, here's the interesting part. Lamech, if you look at, we're going to Genesis 4:22 now. Lamech had two wives, Ada and Zillah. And by Zillah, he had Tubal-Cain. And the very last line in the genealogy of the line of Cain in Genesis 4 is, and the sister of Tubal-Cain is Naama. And so we have to wonder, why did God mention Naama? Who is she? Why does she have any significance whatsoever? Her significance, and if this is depicted in Greek art, her significance is that Ham abducted her. She was very beautiful. Her name basically means beautiful and precious and so forth. And Noah's son Ham abducted her and brought her through the flood as his wife. That's how the Way of Cain got through the flood. And then after the flood, she had long life. She brought long life with her, just as Shem had long life and Noah had long life after the flood. And she never did get rid of the way of Cain, way of being. And after the flood, she instigated the rebellion against Noah and his God-fearing offspring. And she became worshipped as all these different goddesses you hear about because of what happened in Babylon when there was the many languages. I think it says when God disintegrated their lip and made all these different languages, she's called by a lot of different names, Inanna, Ishtar, so forth, and she ultimately got her supreme deification. This is the woman Naama from Genesis who came through the flood as Ham's wife. she got her ultimate deification as Athena. And actually, Athena's name is Athana from the most ancient Greek, which is Linear B. And over time, it elided into Athena, which is easier to pronounce than Athana. And her name actually means immortal one, because Athana is short for Athanatos, which means deathlessness. So they viewed her as being deathless and immortal. And in her Parthenon idol image and in other images of her, she's wearing this armor. And if you look at Genesis 6, we who are part of the body of Christ have an armor also. We're supposed to put on the panoply or the whole armor of God, which includes a shield and a helmet and a breastplate and so forth. And Athena has all this, except there's one big difference. She doesn't have the sword of the Spirit, which is a declaration of God, because those that are part of the way of Cain are not interested in declarations of God. In fact, one of the members of the line of Cain, above her, Mehujael, I think it's the grandson of Cain himself, his name means wipe out God. So the way of Cain got extremely corrupt, even in the third or fourth generation. But we're talking about Athena and wearing all this armor. And she has everything that's mentioned in Genesis 6, except one thing. She doesn't have the sword of the Spirit, which is a declaration of God. She has a spear. And it was a spear that Saul, King Saul, who was a man of, represents a man of the flesh, used three different times to try to kill King David, a man of the Spirit and a type of Christ. So this figure, Athena, is an enemy of the saints of God. And I believe she is the god of this eon who blinds the minds of them that believe not. And the King James refers to her as the god of, and in that passage, it says the god of this world, but it's a mistranslation. It should say god of this age or eon. So, and a lot of people mistake that for Satan, but Satan's still in the heavenly realms. He hasn't come to earth yet, as he's going to during the very end. So she, I think, is the one running the show as the god of this eon who blinds the minds of them that believe not. I mean, she's the goddess of philosophy, and the scripture says, beware lest anyone despoil you through philosophy and empty seduction and so forth. But, Tony, am I going on too long?
I find this very interesting because there's a lot of information that I don't know about, and I'm sure most people don't. And what I really find interesting, Robert, is you came back from the war, and in order to, I guess, it's a form of therapy, having you write and you know, to get it out, right? And you know, that magazine that you're talking about, Progressive, it's still there, The Progressive. You can find it on progressive.org. It turned into it evolved into something. Now, were you into this before the war? This all just came out from seeing a statue at West Point and coming back and dealing with the struggles from being a nom. This all evolved out of that. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, just over the years, I was curious. I mean, the Academy Crest had Athena's helmet, and we wore it on our collars when we went to class every day, and I'm thinking, what is this? I mean, she's the goddess of wisdom, and then when you find out that the truth is, Athena is the goddess of the Genesis serpent wisdom, and I don't think there's any cadets at West Point today that realize that. Then she's the goddess of war. Well, who's she waging war against? If you look at the ancient Greek art, she's waging war against the saints of God. She wages war against the Yahweh-believing sons of Noah. And, in fact, this is depicted in great detail on a huge altar in a place called Pergamum. Some people call it Pergamos. It's called different things. But it's mentioned in the book of Revelation. And there, that was where the altar of Zeus was, and that the sculpture went all around the side of it. It's on a huge mountain overlooking the Aegean Sea, It's about maybe 50 kilometers south of Troy, if you can picture that, across the Aegean Sea from Athens, across the Aegean. It's in modern-day Turkey, on the corner of modern-day, the western edge of modern-day Turkey. And it depicts the ancestors in the way of Cain crushing the Yahweh-believing sons of Noah. And they stick Noah in the corner. He's the only one that's not actually engaged in the fighting. They put him there to observe the end of his reign and the triumph of the way of Cain after the flood. Now, one of the interesting things is that this altar of Zeus in Pergamum, Jesus referred to in Revelation 2:13 as the throne of Satan. So, you know, there it is. I mean, this is the throne of Satan. And then also, every year, go ahead, Tony.
Oh, you're good. You're good. I was just agreeing with you.
Okay.
I was agreeing with you. What I want to make sure, though, because time goes faster, Robert, I want to make sure a couple of things. First of all, you have this book out, and there's a couple questions I have. One, is there another book coming? And two, there's another book coming. Okay, we got that. Now, what I have found is when you write a book, it's hard not to write the second book. It's just something that happens. But what is it that you have been able to gain out of this book that has been so helpful to others?
Well, it validates the book of Genesis for people whose faith may be a little weak. This ark is 2,500 years old. We're talking 400 and 500 B.C. Temple ark, the Temple of Athena, and so forth. And it, without a doubt, and I show it step by step, it Greek religious art from that time chronicles the triumph of the way of Cain after the flood. And you see, it's the history of humanity. There it is. And you don't find that in school. Because of the teaching of evolutionism, you've got anthropologists studying chimpanzees instead of looking at this ancient art where the Greeks are telling us what happened. Now, see, the Greek point of view, it's the same people, the same events from Genesis and from ancient Greek art. The difference is the Greeks believe serpent enlightened mankind instead of deluding mankind. So they exalt the serpent and lift the serpent up. That's why there's this huge Genesis serpent rising up inside Athena's shield, inside the Parthenon. And you stop and think about it. The Parthenon took 15 years to build. It's Athena's temple on the Acropolis. And the reason they built it was to elevate these sculptures and tell their story. You don't spend 15 years building a marble temple in order to express myths. It's the atheist in academia, the evolutionists, who say, oh, well, it's all myth. I was up at a Greek church festival where everybody had a lot of displays out there, and I had a display out of my other books, and I had a DVD running, and I had some art work showing up there. And someone from the classics department, this was in Baltimore, from the classics department of Johns Hopkins University, came walking up to our display, and he got within, I'd say, 25 feet of it, 20 or 25 feet of it. And he put both his arms straight out with his palms up, and he just said, no, 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 and turned around and walked away. Because that's how they deal with it. My work has never been refuted. It's always denied. And a creation creation. I'm trying to think of a phrase. I can't think of it. But anyhow, what was your question again, Tony? Oh, I have other books besides this.
I'm looking at it now on Amazon. You've written a lot of books.
Yes,
Go ahead.
About 10 years ago, I wrote. Go ahead.
I don't want to interrupt you, Robert, but we're down to about 2 minutes left, and I got to end the show. But what I want to make sure is that people can find you. What I find interesting, and maybe I'm making light of it, but you came home from the war and you had some issues to deal with, and through those issues, you were able to work your way all the way to here and become a writer of many, many books. So I think that people need to know how to contact you, how to find your books, and how to if you come out and speak or whatever it is that they do. I'd like them to have that information before we run out of time.
Okay. Well, my website is genesisingreekart.com. Genesisingreekart.com. All you have to do is Google Genesis Greek Art, and my website comes up first. And I've got some other books, too. I did Outing the Moronocracy, Ending the Rule of the Blind, the Stupid, and the Disgraceful in American Society. That's at themoronocracy.com. And I don't want to go into all these other things, but this is huge. I mean, the idea that the Greeks knew exactly about the flood. They depict the flood. They have vase depictions and sculpted depictions of how they saw the flood. They depicted the ancient garden with the serpent entwined apple tree. They depicted Adam and Eve as Zeus and Hera. Of course, that's Zeus is the serpent-friendly Adam, and Hera is the serpent.
I hate to interrupt you, but we're going to go dead here in about 30 seconds. So what I want to do is make sure to get you back up on the show and go over some more stuff with you. But I apologize. I have to end the show now because we're out of time. So thank you for your time today. I hope that you'll come back and share some more with us. And I appreciate, once again, your service to our military for our country. I want to say thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm delighted, and thank you for giving me so much time to talk to you and your listeners.
All right. Thank you. Folks, we're up against the clock. No time for a closeout. So just join us next week, 7:30 to 8:30 Central Standard Time on the Tough Talk Christian Radio. Have a blessed day.